The Guardian.
Nova is America's most watched science series. You'll find it every night at 7:50 on PBS, Sky Channel 166, Virgin Media 243. PBS, where television matters.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week,
whether or not I feel the pain of someone starving or being hacked to death in some remote part of the world, I know it's wrong. I know that it can't be justified.
Steven Pinker expounds on the subject of violence and its ever-decreasing part in human society. He's here to discuss his latest book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. And
every time you drink water, you're drinking in atoms from the sweat of your parents' coupling that created you. Just think of that.
We've got part two of Professor Lawrence Krauss's lecture on cosmic connections. Plus, we try to explain quantum levitation. Stay tuned. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Steven Pinker is a celebrated scientist whose work moves across a number of disciplines. From linguistics to cognitive science and experimental psychology, he's the author of six scholarly works, including The Language Instinct, How the Mind Works, Words and Rules, The Blank Slate, and The Stuff of Thought. In his latest book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Pinker sets out to prove a seemingly simple but profound pattern about the nature of human psychology and society. He says that in relative terms, the world is becoming a less violent place, and that many common assumptions about the supposed increase in violence, well, they're just simply wrong. The first few chapters of his book are stuffed full of extensive statistical, forensic, historical, and scientific research to show that the number of violent deaths in the world really is going down. Then he gets to examining why. In this extract from my interview with Steven Pinker, I asked him about the developing research into psychology and neuroscience, which might shed some light on the demons that he says are at the root of our human propensity for violence, and also the better angels of his title that help us to avoid it. One of your angels is empathy. And you talk about the potential cognitive bases for it. And there's some really interesting new research going on into things like oxytocin, the hormone, the cuddle chemical,
yes.
And mirror neurons and things, which are both a mechanism in the brain to allow you to sort of feel kinship and warmth towards people. How much do we really know whether that's a real thing or whether it's just sort of tempting to think that it somehow exists in the brain, that there's a sort of empathy bit to your brain?
Yes. Mirror neurons are probably a red herring. They probably have nothing to do with empathy in the sense of compassion or sympathetic concern.
And these are neurons which are directed to copying behavior or feeling the same feelings as someone or something that you're looking at.
Probably. What we know about them literally is simply that they fire either when the animal executes a particular motion, like grasping, or when it sees another animal executing that action. It's been extrapolated to empathy, although the extrapolation is dubious. I think a better candidate is the oxytocin system, which does seem to correlate with various warm and cuddly and compassionate feelings. But there is reason to be skeptical of how much empathy powered the large-scale declines of violence, because our sense of empathy, though it can be expanded, and there are experiments showing that if you read someone else's first-person account or listen to them, you then are more sympathetic to that person and the category of that person represents. How strong those effects are is another story. And by default, our sense of empathy is triggered by cute little babies and fuzzy animals and our spouse and our brothers and sisters and our mothers. It can be expanded, but there are certainly limits. On the other hand, reason, that is the realization that there's nothing special about me. And whether or not I feel the pain of someone starving or being hacked to death in some remote part of the world, I know it's wrong. I know that it can't be justified. To get that going, you don't really have to feel their pain. You just have to know that it's indefensible to allow them to suffer. And the conclusion that I came to in the book, having reviewed the history of all of these declines, is that many of them were propelled more by reason than by empathy. empathy can go only so far. But as you have a more rational, intellectualized society, there's some practices that just can no longer be justified. Not that empathy can't help the process along, but that it's ultimately reason and rationality that lead them to be eliminated.
Are there other biological triggers that might sort of explain bits of this decline too, or even explain violence itself? I mean, are there genes that are candidates for people being more violent particularly, or even more caring? I mean, we know that testosterone, for example, is something that's a risk factor for people being violent, which is why, you know, the most risky chromosome to have is a Y chromosome, in terms of violence. That's right. The biggest risk factor, right?
Although testosterone doesn't make people violent so much as it makes them competitive, rising to a challenge. Dominance competitions are only one of several sources of violence, and they don't necessarily lead to violence. So it's certainly a risk factor, but testosterone is not a violence hormone directly.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, in terms of the genetics, then, are there leads to?
There are a number of them. In the violent direction, there is amount of testosterone and receptors for testosterone. There are enzymes that metabolize catecholamine neurotransmitters, and in some versions, they don't metabolize them as well, leaving people more prone to violence. MAOA gene, for example, has an allele that has been associated with violent outbursts.
This is the gene that was very common in certain populations in the South Pacific. Is that right?
There was a claim that it was of higher frequency in the Maori, the indigenous people of New Zealand, although there's a lot of uncertainty and controversy over that claim. More solid are claims that within a particular population, the individuals who have the particular allele of MAOA are more likely to get into trouble from impulsive violence. And one Dutch family where it was absent altogether, and there were and it was inherited in a Mendelian pattern, and each of the people with the defective allele had a severe history of violence. Then there are also genes that may be associated with reduction in violence. It's possible that genes, for example, that expand the size or the connectivity of the prefrontal cortex would result in greater self-control. It's possible, there's reason to believe that whatever genes affect reasoning ability, namely intelligence, could indirectly lead the person to become less violent, holding all else constant.
Now, in the sort of 10,000 or so years that we're talking about in terms of the decline in people being murdered and so on, is it correct to say that the human mind has been the same in that entire time? Is there not a chance that cultural and genetic evolution has occurred in that time to pressure us towards the things you found? So if for example people are particularly violent, then perhaps in the last few thousand years they're the ones that have preferentially been taken out of society by being put in prison or killing themselves, in fact. Mm-hmm. So therefore the ones who are less violent stay in the population. I wonder how much can you really say about the selection pressures going on in the last few millennia?
Yes, I consider that in some detail in the book. I come down on just on grounds of parsimony in saying that that there hasn't been a recent genetic change in humans for two reasons. Not to deny that there could be, there absolutely could be. We don't know that there hasn't been, but there's no evidence that there has been. We know that some of the reductions in violence can take place over scales that are far too rapid to be attributable to natural selection, say over the last 20 years. Given that violence can come down that quickly through reasons that can't be genetic, one has everything one needs to explain the longer-term declines in violence that at least in principle could be genetic. Also, there is a way of testing that prediction. Namely, if you think, for example, that living in a state society for large numbers of generations has weeded out tendencies towards violence, then that predicts that people who have lived in anarchy until recently, say hunter-gatherers, would be genetically more prone to violence than those who've lived in settled state societies. Now, that's clearly a hypothesis that has rather strong political and moral implications, which is one of the reasons that it may not be tested anytime soon. But it's also true that, at least to a first approximation, probably a baby that was taken from a hunter-gatherer tribe, given up for adoption, and raised in a modern society would not be very different from those of its contemporaries whose ancestors had been in living in state societies for long periods of time. It doesn't look as if hunter-gatherers are that biologically different from you and me. That may be wrong, but to the extent that it's true, it would suggest that there has not been recent selection for nonviolence.
I suppose the second part of that question I asked was about cultural evolution, which has been sort of the theme throughout our conversation, actually, about the people's morals changing, states changing, people around you. In the 10,000 odd years, biologically we might be the same, but cognitively, culturally, we're very different. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, of course, reason and in that case, education and self-knowledge as part of the reason why things are moving in the direction they are doing. What's your prediction, if I can ask that, given that scientists don't like to make too many predictions, but what is your prediction for this trend? Is it going to continue?
I suspect it will, not necessarily all over the world, but I think the world's getting smarter. The world's literally gotten smarter in this narrow sense that IQ scores have increased over most of the 20th century and all over the world, the Flynn effect. But
On that, I noticed there was a fascinating thing in there about modern teenagers. For any parents who think that their teenagers are a bit lazy, to give them some hope.
Yes, a teenager today, if time transported back to the first part of the century, would have had an IQ of 130.
Yeah.
Now, by the way, it doesn't mean the teenagers of today know more. And in fact, in skills such as vocabulary and arithmetic, there's been very little improvement. But in abstract reasoning, in solving analogy problems, like tree is to seed as a bird is to, and you have to fill in the blank, a teenager today, it would be far better than his counterpart of many decades beforehand. That is, modern societies, that process can't go on forever. We're not going to get, our IQs aren't going to just increase linearly indefinitely. But in societies where they were lower to begin with, I think we can expect to see continued improvement because the Flynn effect is driven by two trends that are likely to accumulate in the developing world, namely education and the trickling down of scientific and analytic concepts into everyday discourse through literacy and media. There's no reason to think that won't happen elsewhere in the world.
Does technology help as well? I mean, with the web, people see other people's lives much more easily and they're more able to connect with people all around the world. So you see yourself as less different. So therefore, treating someone else in a sort of inhuman or alien way is you'd be more thoughtful about that.
I suspect that that has happened and well before the development of the web. I suspect that that happened in the 18th century with the rise of print and literacy and affordable books and popular fiction. I think it may have been taken to a new level in starting in the 1950s with the rise of television and transistor radios, where it was said that we lived in a electronic global village even back then, and it might be taken to the next level by the internet. And there are reasons to think that with each one of these technological developments, there was on its heels an advance in humanitarian sentiments. So the rise of literacy and printing in the 17th century could have led to the humanitarian reforms of the Enlightenment in the 18th century, such as the abolition of breaking on the wheel and slavery and despotism and so on. It's not implausible that many of the anti-war sentiments of the 1960s were helped along by footage of the Vietnam War being brought into your living room in real time. Civil rights movement, it's harder to think of blacks as inferior when you see them hear their words on talk shows and in popular entertainment. And it's quite possible that social media and the internet will have a similar function throughout the world in the 21st century.
Now, you say you wrote the book in response to a question. I think this is one of John Brockman's annual questions. He asked a few years ago, what are you optimistic about? And many people answered in very different ways. And your answer was this 800-page book.
It was 800 words that grew into 800 pages.
Grew into this.
Yes.
So this magnificent book. Are you still optimistic after having written all of this?
Yes. Although, as I explained in the book, the attitude is more of gratitude than optimism, in that you have to be humble in making predictions about the world as a whole. Experts have often been humiliated, or ought to have been humiliated, by confident predictions that have turned out to be false. On the other hand, we do know with much greater confidence what has taken place retrospectively. And a lot of good things have happened, and we ought to be grateful for them and ought to work hard at identifying their causes.
Professor Steven Pinker there. The full interview will be released as a Science Weekly extra via our podcast feed. So if you want to hear the full width of his arguments, subscribe to our feed and download the interview in full. His book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, is out now.
So what have we got here?
So we have quantum locking. The superconductor is locked in space, and it stays wherever I put it. You see, this is quantum trapping.
Amazing.
As long as it's
so the superconductor.
Time for a very quick bit of news. You might have seen a quite remarkable video doing the rounds on YouTube recently, where a scientist douses a ceramic disc with liquid nitrogen and then leaves it to hover over a magnet. It just sits there, stuck in space. Then it gets better. He takes the frozen disc to a table where there's a ring of magnets around the edge. Like a hockey puck skimming effortlessly across an ice rink, the ceramic disc flies around the edge of the table, the whole time a few centimetres away from touching anything. What's going on? We thought we'd get the man in the film, Boaz Almog of Tel Aviv University, to explain. I started by asking him, is this just another clever way of doing magnetic levitation, or maglev, that powers some of the trains you see in places like China?
Our demonstration is a little bit different than the usual maglev demonstrations. Because when you see maglev levitation, you have two effects. The first one is the Meissner effect, when you have the repelling of magnetic fields from the superconductor. And this effect is very strong, and what it actually gives you is a strong repulsion between the magnet and the superconductor.
This is familiar to anyone who's held a magnet, two north poles of a magnet together.
Yeah, exactly. And however, this effect does not happen here, because our superconductor is very, very thin. So the Meissner effect does not have any effect here in our demonstration. What happens here is only the second effect, which is the locking of magnetic field inside the superconductor.
This is the flux trapping you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
So to just take us back one step. In the demonstration, you have a disk of superconductor which you pour liquid nitrogen onto, which makes it into a superconductor. What is this stuff made of? I mean, how what is it?
Oh, it's a rather complicated compound. It consists of rare earth metals like yttrium, and metals like barium and copper, which we all know. And oxide, of course. It's a ceramic material. It has no interesting properties when you heat it up to room temperature. It's like a plate, something. And only when you cool it to liquid nitrogen temperatures, then you start seeing this effect.
So this particular superconductor, what would its uses be if you wanted to make it functional somehow?
Okay, so I think the main application for such superconductors are in terms of electricity, because you can drive currents in them and they will just they will not lose the energy, they will not lose the current. So what people are trying to do all around the world is they're trying to make wires out of them.
Out of these ceramics.
Yeah, and it's quite difficult, because if you ever tried to look at a plate, for example, that you have in your kitchen, and trying to make wires out of a plate is quite difficult. It's brittle and it's impossible, practically impossible. So, but there are other techniques when you can just make this superconductor flexible.
Yeah. And what about this very interesting property of it floating around, this flux trapping? I mean, when people saw that video, you could see the blogs and the comments all around the world going that you could make hoverboards out of this, like in Back to the Future. What do you think?
Actually, you know, this effect, we didn't expect this effect when we tried this experiment for the first time only a few months ago. It's a side effect of our superconductors. And besides demonstration, I don't know if we can really use it, at least in the near future, because you have to have a very strong magnetic field in order for this flux trapping to be effective.
Dr. Boaz Almog of Tel Aviv University there on quantum levitation, destroying the hoverboard dreams of all science fiction fans. If you want to see the demonstration he was talking about, go to our blog where you'll find a link. Something else you might want to check out this week.
The heart's a really remarkable organ. It has to beat throughout our lifetime without pausing. And in our lifetime, which we expect these days to be at least 80 years, the heart will beat 3 billion times. That's 30 with 8 zeros after it. That's a big number. And that is true whether you're a mouse or whether you're an elephant or you're a man.
That was Mike Shattuck of King's College London there talking about what happens when your heart beats. Mike features in the first of a new series of films we're bringing you in association with the British Heart Foundation. The films will explore the detailed biology of the heart and will be online every Friday through November. Now we're going to continue the cosmological adventure started last week. London-based organisation The School of Life invited Lawrence Krauss, a leading American theoretical physicist and director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University. He was there to discuss our place in the cosmos in his own witty and entertaining way. In part two of the lecture, Lawrence delves into the intimate and sometimes unsettling molecular makeup of the universe, and that includes us.
One of the interesting things is when the Earth formed, the temperature in the region of in the first 10 or 100 million years of the formation of our solar system, the temperature was about 1,000 degrees in this region, which is clearly too hot for water to exist. Yet we live on a water-filled planet. And the big question is, how did the water get here? The answer is, we don't know, sort of. Which is, by the way, the best answer in science. Because the other thing people don't realize about science, which differentiates it from religion, is that the most exciting thing about being a scientist is not knowing. Well, there's two things. Being wrong is up there, too. Because that means there's a lot left to learn. And well, we have some ideas, and it turns out comets have been impacting on the Earth for 4.5 billion years, because the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. And if you work it out, there's been enough water delivered to the Earth by comets over that 4.5 billion year period to fill up the oceans, to make all the oceans. But we kind of thought that as wonderful as that is, it's actually wrong. It's amazing when something works out perfectly and you find out it's wrong. That's the other wonderful thing that I've had that experience many times because I've been wrong many times. That when it just looks elegant and beautiful and it's wrong. And that's the other gift that science has for us, because every time, I hope all of you have that experience at least once in your life, that something you deeply and profoundly believe in because it's beautiful and elegant and wonderful turns out to be wrong. Because then you can open your mind. The reason we thought it was wrong is if we look at the abundance of an isotope of hydrogen, heavy hydrogen called deuterium, we can look at it in the Earth's oceans and we can measure that one part in about 100,000 of the Earth's ocean is heavy water. But when we look at the abundance of deuterium in comets that we measured, it was different. And therefore, it didn't seem that the water from comets could be delivering the water on Earth. And that was a big mystery. It's actually turned out this very week, for the very first time, a new comet was measured, and in fact, it was discovered that the abundance of deuterium in that comet happened to be exactly the same as our oceans. So we're all, everyone's abuzz, because maybe this new type of comet could have delivered our water. But one of the places we want to find out the answer to that is not on Earth, because the problem with the Earth is that the Earth's surface has been changing all the time. Due to global tectonics, The continents are disappearing and going under the oceans in many places, and coming up again as carbon dioxide and volcanic lava. So we can't look on the surface of the Earth for material that is truly primordial. So we want to go to another place, and this is the place we would want to go to for this. This looks like Los Angeles in the evening, but it's not. It's Mars, the red sky. And because the surface of Mars is quite interesting, because we think there's water on it, but it doesn't have volcanoes on it anymore. It's not driven by global tectonics, so we hope that the water we might find on Mars will be pristine and primordial, and we can learn whether the water that came from there is the same as the comets. But the really neat thing that I wanted to tell you is to find out about the surface of Mars, we don't have to go to Mars. We just have to go to a place on Earth that looks like Mars. Where's this? It's Antarctica. And the amazing thing is, we go to Antarctica to find Mars. Why? Well, this is what Antarctica looks like. And there's one important fact about this picture. I should ask you, what strikes you about this picture? It's white, exactly. Good, I didn't think that would be the first answer. Good. It's white, and that means if you look for brown things, well, either animals have been there, or it's a meteorite. So we go to Antarctica to look for meteorites, not because more meteorites fall in Antarctica than anywhere else. They don't. But if you're driving along the ice and you see something that isn't white, it's a meteorite. In London, you see something that isn't white, And so this particular meteorite found in the Allen Hills in Antarctica is actually a bit of Mars. And we realized when we discovered these things, how do we know? Because we sent a probe to Mars and we were able to look at the composition of the Martian soil, and this has exactly that composition. So we learned, much to our amazement initially, that bits of Mars are falling on Earth all the time. And that's not too surprising, because there are comets and meteorites impacting on the surface of Mars, and they're getting knocked out, and some of them make their way to Earth. And about 20 years ago, with this particular meteorite, some NASA chemists sliced it open and discovered these things. And this was remarkable, because these things look a lot like these things. And these things are the oldest fossils of life on Earth, many people think. It's still a little controversial. But these could, we think, are fossilized remnants of the first single-celled organisms that evolved on Earth, and again, I can use the word evolved since I'm not in the United States for a while. They evolved on Earth within 500 million years of the formation of the Earth, about as soon as the laws of physics allowed. And that's amazing, because it means that life seems to be formed not only ubiquitously, but easily. But now the key question comes, well, this is interesting, because if we see these things on a Martian meteorite, are these fossil evidence of life on Mars? And in fact, there was a press conference where President Clinton at the time announced that potentially we had found evidence for life elsewhere in the universe. Now, it turns out to have been wrong. It turns out these things are about 1/50th the size of these things, and we think there are standard geochemical ways of producing this without biology. But what we did learn is that no planet is an island. That we are polluted regularly by material from Mars, and vice versa. Material from the Earth gets knocked out sometimes, a lot less often, and can make its way to Mars. So that if life evolved on one planet in our solar system, particularly on Mars, and the early history of life on Mars was it was hotter and wetter, we've also learned that there are extremophiles on Earth, that everywhere we look on Earth, we find different kinds of life, and that life can exist in conditions we would have once thought was impossible. And we certainly know that microbes in the Siberian deserts and can exist without water under harsh conditions for months or years at a time in a dormant state. And so there's no doubt that if microbes existed in rocks on Mars, they could make the 6-month trip to Earth once they were knocked out from the surface with no problem. So the big question is, did life on Earth arise here or somewhere else? Maybe we are all extraterrestrials. So we may be connected in a profoundly new way with life elsewhere in the universe. In particular, I thoroughly expect when we explore the surface of Mars, we will find fossilized evidence of life. Specifically because of that interplay. But the big surprise would be if it isn't our cousins. The big surprise would be to find out that it didn't use exactly the same mechanisms for life, DNA, replication, ATP for energy production, that it wasn't the same life as we find here. If it was different, that would be a huge surprise. And we may not find it there. We may find it. There's lots of places in the solar system we're going to look for life. Under the surface of Mars is one place. In under the oceans of Europa, the various moons of Jupiter and Saturn, we think there are liquid oceans and heat. And we've discovered that, as far as we can tell, the conditions for life existing on Earth or life evolving are water, organic materials, and sunlight. And they're all in abundance. There's lots of stars. There's lots of water. And there are lots of organic materials. We've actually looked at things. And one of the things we discovered from the Hale-Bopp comet was not that there was a little spacecraft behind it, for those that are old enough to remember that, but rather that they're organic materials. The basis of amino acids exist on comets. All of the building blocks for life exist and existed to be delivered to Earth, but also to be delivered to the other planets. So it is quite likely we have cosmic cousins that are either long dead on Mars or maybe still alive under the oceans of Europa. And we may, in the lifetime of some people in this room, find them. So that was the second cosmic connection. The third are, not only are we cousins to everyone else in the universe, but we are each other. We are the people we hate. Well, in my case, I know that on a regular basis, but we are, and I want to take you to do a physics experiment, which I do with every introductory physics class. So this is your British audience, you're classically trained. Who's this? Who? Not Marcus Aurelius. Close. Caesar. There we go. Okay. I knew I'd find someone here. Caesar. Okay. What I want you to do is all of you take a deep breath and hold it in until I tell you to let go. Okay? Keep holding it in. Okay. So, the amazing thing is that life evolved on Earth for 2 billion years before it began to use oxygen. And before that, it didn't use oxygen, it used photosynthesis. Okay, let go. Okay. The British audience is very obedient. If I did this in the States, everyone would be breathing. But anyway, oxygen is vitally important for us, we've discovered. You can only live without it for a few minutes. But that changed everything. When life discovered how to use oxygen, which was only about 2 billion years into the history of the Earth, because, by the way, there used to be no oxygen on Earth, no free oxygen. One of the ways we may discover life elsewhere in the universe is by looking at other planets and looking for oxygen atmospheres, because all of the oxygen created on Earth was created by life. It used to be in the form of carbon dioxide. No free oxygen existed when the Earth existed. All of the oxygen on Earth now is created by life forms, initially single-celled molecules, single-celled life forms that learned how to do photosynthesis at the surface of the Earth and took carbon dioxide and water and puffed out little bits of oxygen over billions and billions of years. It took about 2 billion years before the present oxygen atmosphere was there. But that tells us that we are connected in a remarkable way, not just to everything else in the universe, but to everything that's ever existed on Earth. Because when you took that deep breath and held it in, it turned out, one can show, that in every breath you take, there are on average at least 10 oxygen atoms from the dying breath of Caesar when he said, "Et tu, Brute." Every time you breathe in, every single time you breathe in, you're breathing in atoms that Caesar breathed out in his dying breath. But not only that, not just Caesar, but almost everyone else who ever lived. Because you can work out the time it takes for oxygen to be recycled in the atmosphere, and you can work out how many atoms there are in the atmosphere, how many atoms there are each time you breathe, and every time you breathe, you're breathing in atoms from basically everyone who ever lived, making up your body. From people that seem strange and different. And for me, as a theoretical physicist, every time I'm sitting at my desk getting nothing done, which is often, I sit there and I think every time I'm breathing in, I'm breathing in atoms that Einstein breathed out when he wrote the last step of the equation of general relativity. So you can decide, depending on a good day or a bad day, how you feel. You are connected in a way to everyone who's ever lived. Here's me and Lucy. Every time I breathe in, she's a little young lady that lived about 3 million years ago, and I'm breathing in atoms from Lucy. I'm breathing in atoms from these stromatolites, which were the original single-celled objects. These are fossils in Shark Bay, Australia. But every time they puffed out that oxygen, they're atoms that I'm breathing in from their creation. And it's not just breathing, it's drinking. This, again, is a British audience, so Shakespeare seems important, useful. Will all great Neptune's oceans wash this blood clean from my hand? You remember this from Macbeth. No, this my hand will rather the multitudinous seas incarnadine. Let me turn that into English, modern English. Remember every time when he killed the king and he said, my hands, they won't clean. Every time I dip my hands into water, I turn the water red. Well, it's true in a general sense. If you prick your finger and drop a drop of your blood in the Thames River and then go out in the ocean a year later, and take a spoonful of water, there'll be some of the atoms of your blood in that water. You are connected. Every time you drink, you're drinking in liquid excreted by every slimy thing that ever existed. And I don't normally say this in a public audience, but here it will be unique, because I wrote it in my book once, but it's true. Every time you drink water, you're drinking in atoms from the sweat of your parents' coupling that created you. Just think of that. Anyone want some water?
Okay. Well, I hope that doesn't put you off your next trip to the Waterfront. Thanks to Lawrence Krauss there and to the good folk of the School of Life for permission to bring you that lecture. For more information on the School of Life, check out their website, theschooloflife.com. We'll have the third and final part of that lecture on next week's programme. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
Nova is America's most watched science series. You'll find it every night at 7:50 on PBS, Sky Channel 166, Virgin Media 243. PBS, where television matters.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.